You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Newton Harrison. Newton, thank you so much for being with me today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I'm happy to be here, Brainerd.
Newton, let's talk about what it is that you're working on now. I want to talk about your book, After 45 Years, about the lifetime of making work, but what is it that you're working on at the moment or involved with?
Well, I'm involved mostly with our Center for the Study of the Force Majeure, which is a nonprofit put forth by the arts division at the University of California at Santa Cruz. And I should lay out what it is we worry about most. What we worry about is, and why we call it a force majeure, is we cop a legal term. And we do that because how else can you describe three things that are happening simultaneously, which are warming across all surfaces, ocean rise, and an emerging sixth extinction? They're three giant waves, and collectively they are a force of our own making. And what I've been doing mostly with a small team so far, but growing, is working on first on the three things we work on most, which is mediating things like the sixth extinction and warming at million square kilometer scale and drought and things of that sort. I'm working most immediately on what we call future gardens. A future garden has, all these works have a metaphorical base, and the future garden base is every place is the story of its own becoming. And we hold that any place that is a place, that a small watershed, a little prairie, that can be called a place that resisted heat or lived well through a 3 or 4 degree centigrade temperature rise, even though sudden, that lived through it and had species there, has the genetic material in it to do it all over again. And so what we do and are doing is propagating discovering and then propagating the most resilient species in the sage hen watershed, for instance. In that case, we grew 15,000 plants. We planted them at 5 altitudes. To give you context, the sage hen watershed is the research station, close to 9,000 acres, close to Lake Tahoe, that is the Berkeley Research Station, and I'm where you see people, and we're working there. And we planted 12,500 plants with 21 species varying, and at 5 altitudes, about 500 feet apart. And over 4 years, we tested who lived. And it turned out that of those 20 who were selected for resilience, almost a third of them lived at all altitudes, about 25% lived at all altitudes and under drought, flood, 10 feet of snow, and then drought again. And so that tells us that we can make these future gardens, and that anybody can, and that therefore you can begin your defense mechanisms early and actually assist the migration of species through time. And so 50, 75 years from now, if you have these things, if you have done your work right, you have the scaffolding for an ecosystem to move in as many species die from heat, probably disease, and drought or erratic rains. And so we're doing this at Sage Hen, at the research station. We're also doing a future garden at the Arboretum in UC Santa Cruz. We've proposed 5 futures for the Los Angeles Basin, for the L.A. County Museum, and the DiCaprio Foundation at the Tar Pits Park there, and that's under consideration. And we've just proposed or started to design with two teams a large floodplain future garden in Scotland on the Dee River above Aberdeen. So that's the kind of stuff we're doing on the ground. One last thing is that scaling up, if you take a look at the peninsula of Europe, you look at our book, you will see it's about 3.3 million square kilometers with around 450 million people there. And drought, and there's about 2.4 million square kilometers of farmland, and about a third of that farmland will undergo severe drought and become non-productive. Well, if you have oceans rising, land shrinks a bit, people have to rise, the food supply drops by 20-25% maybe more, the population increases in that area, maybe 10-15%, you have the basis for civil collapse. And so we've done a design that would repair the food supply system or reduce the stress on it by probably enough to avoid, I guess you'd call starvation. So that's the kind of stuff we're working on. Well, and as artists, we're storytellers. And we actually believe that the built landscape is the result of people telling each other stories and acting out their desires. And that's what we're doing.
And that's a very exciting project, not just in terms of talking to you about this kind of work, but also it's about saving the planet, really, right? This work couldn't have a larger scope, in a sense. It's about existence itself, it seems. And the question I want to ask before looking at this in the context of all of your work, where does funding for this come? This seems, of course, that it should be funded by our government, and some of the hundreds of billions going into the military could be used for this process. But I imagine that none of this is government funding. Is that the case that's helping to produce these future gardens?
Well, okay. The future gardens have been funded by a section of the Annenberg Foundation, the Metabolic Studio. The first one for $250,000, and the others, there's one other one in China that we're working on I didn't mention. And the others are funded at much smaller levels, but you don't need much to do one of these. Conversely, we have the Future Garden concept and imagery and design on display in a big art and ecology exhibition, Ecovention, in Maastricht. And that damn thing is going to cost about what a Bush war costs, about $1 trillion, about 1.2 million euro per square kilometer. But it would need to take place over 20, 30 years, so it could be done through taxes, because the gross national product of Europe is about 10, 12 trillion in any given year, so it's not so much, but the positive outcome would be great. We're working with the gallery director there to see if we can't reach out to Dutch Parliament and thereafter to Angela Merkel, who I know personally, who helped open the Endangered Meadows of Europe work you saw in the middle of the book in the mid-90s, 1995. So, yeah, it takes a lot of money, but why be worried about it?
Right. And what is the total, how do you see the project, let's say, in 20 or 30 years? Where would this project ideally go? What would be the results of it? It seemed that if more people got involved and more of these were built, but, yeah.
Well, what it would do would be the peninsula of Europe was terraformed over a couple thousand years by all the farmers. All small farmers flattened their lands, got rid of the wetlands, increased the growing place, and tipped the land so that the waters from heavy rains would run off after they soaked the land. So what we hold is that you've got to re-tip those lands, often not more than 4 or 5 feet. You know, we're not talking giant bulldozers, but you've got to, because most of the early transformations were by hand and oxen and stuff. So you've got to re-tip this land so that the waters form puddles over aquifers and recharge the aquifers while the puddles themselves or ponds supply the water for farming on the one hand and resupply the continent with wetlands and regenerate the biodiversity that's been taken out. So that our basic concept is you have to address the well-being of the life web first and human problems second. Because if you don't have the life web intact, and we've ripped it apart, but it can regenerate. But if you push it beyond regeneration, and we're heading in that direction, then all life is endangered. So that's where we go.
And to talk about this a little bit in the context of all of your work, I know that the Prestel book is out, the Time of the Force Majeure, and it's looking back on 45 years of your work. Can you tell me a little bit about how that puts into context what you're just discussing now?
Yeah, I mean, Helen's her own. She's 90 and not well, but I'm 85. But we've worked together all these years, and what she was a Chaucer scholar and an educational theorist, and she was the head of educational programs at UC San Diego, where I was the department chair. And what we did was decided to put all of our energy into changing our work, her writing and my art, into a new form where we only help the ecosystem. Well, you know, that's like we 69, 70, we come to this decision, and we have a little problem. We don't know what an ecosystem is. So around 5 years later, we figure all this out. And so you will note that there are 40 or 50 works in the book, and when we get to the Force Majeure, last chapter, you'll note we say, you know what? These 40 works that you've seen here in the book, some of them astonishingly successful, some of them not, but all of them insufficient. Why insufficient when we're facing this force majeure we're talking about? Well, you see, almost all work is patchwork. You're fixing a little place here. You're helping a little place there. You're resolving a racial problem here. You're fixing a river there. Well, if you look at the surface of the globe, there are an infinity of patches. And so we'll exhaust ourselves if we do patchwork. We have to work with systems. There are few systems, and you can work with them. And therefore, we hold that a lot of our early work is insufficient. And the force majeure work are where we focus on working with whole systems. Did that answer or not?
That does answer, and it also makes me think about the context of artists that you were working with in that time and over that span of time, because it makes sense what you're saying in terms of where it comes to now and the direction of the work now. There was probably a lot of other thinkers at the time as all this was developing that you were aware of, Buckminster Fuller or Joseph Beuys, others that were heading, it would seem, in this direction, but perhaps they were still thinking in terms of what you're saying in a kind of patchwork mentality. I mean, how do you feel looking back on some of your peers then, who many of which are not living now, but some of them had similar intentions at the beginning? Would you say that that's correct and in a type of patchwork form, as you're saying?
Well, you know, like Joseph Beuys, there are about 4 or 5 different PhDs chapters that compare how Beuys and ourselves. I've read some of them. See, Boys talked about social sculpture, and he was human-directed, and he saw everything in terms of how humans evolved, and he was in a state of recovery from Nazi Germany and some of the myths he built about being wrapped in fat and felt, some of which seemed to me to be true, some not, but it doesn't matter. He really opened up a lot of amazing kinds of seeing, but it was human-centered, and we have to flip from that which is human-centered to that which is ecologically centered, so that we have to be paying much deeper attention to the life, to the well-being of the life web, which is being ripped up, than to the well-being of everyday people. Not that you forget people, but a great amount of survival is at stake. If you look at Bucky Fuller, whom we've also been compared to, Fuller comes out of engineering, okay? And he comes out of physics, more of that generation. And that generation was more or less contemptuous of, they saw the ecology as a non-discipline, and often saw if you thought about ecosystems thinking, it was a lower order of thing than, say, physics. I remember the art and technology thing where Billy Kluver was working. We didn't get on at all. I was an ecologist, as an artist ecologist, and he thought that ecology was the lesser thing, and the core of thing of everything was came out of the physical laws, which happens to be true. The ecosystem must obey the physical laws, but nonetheless, it is what keeps us alive. So yeah, I'm very familiar with their work and contended with them.
And in the future, as these projects continue and grow, is there a way that listeners can get involved in something like Future Gardens or help and support these activities on their own? It seems that it's something that as many people as possible should be supporting. Is there a means or a way?
Well, okay, take Future Gardens. We designed the whole concept so that any botanist in any region with a volunteer team from, say, a local high school even, could do the kind of analysis we talk about, could look for species in the now. Often, sometimes you have to do paleobotanical research, but look for species in the now that will live in their future. And that since the warming thing is happening so fast, they need to propagate a bunch of stuff in the now so that it's ready to move in the future. And any place that has a good botanist can do this. We're trying to put a model in place that's easy to do. Mind, our first one cost $250,000. Our second one is now costing half that. So what we're hoping is that we're copied. If we're not, then so be it.
And in terms of copying this and more people getting information on this, of course, there's the book, which there'll be a link to in the interview after 45 years, Counterforce is on the Horizon, as the subtitle is, of the time of the force majeure. So you're discussing this. Is there other places that people should also go to be able to understand more about the Future Gardens and ideally replicate them?
Well, the book's only out about 8 months, so I just don't know. There's so much information out that the other information can bury us, or we can catch fire. I can't tell which. We're in a very iffy situation. But, there are gigantic corporations all trying to continue and not change anything. There are counterforces. All kinds of people are arguing against it. The best arguments I know right now are coming out of, I think, Sweden. There's a research team there that has located 9 tipping points back about 3-4 years ago. I think they're located more now. And they're proving that as each tipping point is reached and passed, the life web itself is more threatened. So the most important thing now is to get enough information out so people start to look for and generate a counterforce. Let me talk about that from another perspective. You know, a full extinction, like 93%, I think, of all species died about a couple hundred million years ago. I lost for a moment the age, and it took almost 100 years to regrow, 100 million years to regrow our whole system to its present state. So other extinctions took much less time. The extinction that we're discussing now, according to Paul Ehrlich's work and a number of others, is they're arguing that we may have about 12 million species on our planet, and we may lose as many as half. If we lose as many as half, we'll affect everything. So from our perspective, what you need to do is make large-scale mediation works that make sure we don't lose full half, because we can regenerate if we only lose a third. How do I know this? Well, just look at the glaciers. The glaciers really virtually annihilate the topsoil and everything living except bacteria way down and a few things. And they'll cover 1 million square kilometers as it did in Europe. When the glacier retreats in 12,000 years, there's a regrowth about 70-80% of what was knocked off in the first place. So the planet has invented, the life web has invented resilience, resistance, and the ability to recover from even that kind of shock. And that's what we have to learn from. We don't know for sure, but we're teaching the wrong things. We're not paying attention to how we can continue. Sustainability is not possible. It runs against the laws of indeterminacy. And we're acting as if the physical laws don't exist. We're acting as if, for instance, if you take energy out of a system, the system responds by having less energy to continue. By doing so, it becomes more simple or more uniform. In becoming more uniform, that's another way of saying the entropy rises in that system. And so we've got to reverse the entropy we've enforced on so many of our systems. The world ocean is in terrible shape as a consequence of our behavior, and so on. So we're one, Helen and me and our little team are one group. So one group is not going to save the world, but we think we can put enough information on the table that would group with other informations that maybe network. And when somebody like Trump goes bye-bye, we can reestablish a reasonable capability to survive in this country.
And to look back on, the kind of cultural support of these kinds of things, if that's the word, since this is, you're coming out of, as I see, you know, an ethic, or at least the world of the 60s and 70s, and now we're at the stage where we're at, where so much has changed in terms of technology and communication, but attitudes have also changed, and youth culture has also changed. I mean, or maybe it's not in some ways. And so what I'm asking is, in at the time that some of these projects were started, the 70s, which was a time of idealism on a lot of fronts, and the beginning of so many of these issues, do you see the audience now? And maybe I shouldn't say the young audience, but the college audience, the adult audience, the active audience as we know it, the culture as we know it, Is it becoming more attuned to these issues? Is the tide changing that way in a sense? Some people thought so with a women's march that was kind of unprecedented in size. But in the context of the Future Gardens and the force majeure, do you see more support for that in terms of youth and current culture?
Yeah, but I don't see enough. There has to be a tidal wave of change. And we're part of that tidal wave. Whether it is sufficient and timely enough to reduce for the life web to continue in a way that would let most of the human race also continue is doubtful. Not impossible, but doubtful. So when you ask me what's happening to is the audience growing? You're asking another kind of question. And the question is there some hope around? And the answer is, yeah, but it's really dim right now. But let me now shift to something hopeful. We've been working with the Bucky Fuller people, and one of the chairmen of that group has been working with the 50, and he's on our board, has been working with the 52 Commonwealth nations of Britain. And the smaller the nation, the more concerned the nation, the more bold their ecological solutions are. And so we've been sitting and cogitating on whether we can't make a small nation grouping and stop this big, like the Denmark, like into some parts of Indonesia, and make a small nation grouping that starts to be exemplar of how to change. We're also doing a future garden in China near the Tibetan Plateau, and China is entirely capable of making decisions that change things, and I think they will. So these are hopeful things, but is there an overarching change in our youth? I think not.
And before we go, it's very exciting the work that you're doing, and I'm so glad we had this talk, and hopefully listeners will look at your book and be part of the hope that can help fuel all this. I was wondering before we leave, I usually ask people what they're reading, and I know you're studying. So what is it that you're studying at the moment?
I'm studying at the moment the tipping points. Like, let me give you a funny tipping point. I think we produce something like, the world can process something like 20 or 30 million tons of ammonia. We produce about 120 million tons for fertilizer and things of that sort. So we have exceeded the world's ability to process ammonia. The consequences of that for river bottoms and the like are negative consequences are profound. This group in Denmark, in Sweden, I think, are finding other tipping points that are equally distressing as the carbon one, which would force ocean rise and increase in heat. So what I'm trying to do is locate the whole bunch and begin a discourse on how the world can be re-educated. For instance, the ammonia fertilizer issue, which is also a petroleum issue, has to be broken, and that suggests return to highly efficient small farming that enhances biodiversity is somewhat less efficient than the big pharma, but that will be able to continue where the large farming will not be able to continue since it's exhausting topsoil for profit, you know. So there you have it. There's something deeply wrong with capitalism itself. Nature doesn't charge a profit, yet nature grows. And nature creates excess. And be treating nature's excess as our profit, which would then assist biodiversity and stop us from ripping whole systems off. But that requires a whole lot of thinking, a whole lot of work, and has almost universal disagreement.
Right, unfortunately, so true. Newton, I want to thank you for the work that you've done, you and Helen have done over the years, and I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been fascinating to talk with you.
Brainerd, it's been a pleasure, and I rarely get the opportunity to give this kind of voice to a large enough audience.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.